About a decade ago, parts of the Arab world experienced great upheaval. The events that took place, and which continue to unfold to the present day, are not easily explained. In fact, to this day, and in light of subsequent uprisings, there's an ongoing attempt to fully understand what it is exactly that happened during what has been called the Arab Spring. Can these events be called revolutions? What is a revolution? And how does one determine whether it is successful or not? Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. To tackle these questions and more, TNI's State of Power podcast presents to you Jamie Allinson, who is a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Edinburgh University, an activist and trade unionist, and author of the upcoming book, The Age of Counter-Revolution, States and Revolutions in the Middle East. Jamie is in conversation with anthropologist, internet researcher, and anti-racist campaigner, Miriam Aura. This conversation is part of a series looking at the Arab uprisings a decade afterwards. Links to related webinars, publications, and other materials can be found in the podcast description.
We have seen a lot of interesting semantic differences. So we have seen the use of the word revolutions. We heard uprisings. Then we also will hear from time to time revolts or popular protests. And in a case of two or three cases, I've heard the word intifada used rather than revolutions. And that's really interesting and part of the conversation we will be having today with Jamie. What revolutions are, what they are not, whether we can actually talk about revolutions, even if they failed, how does one agree on what is a successful revolution and how not. So Jamie, welcome. Tell us a bit about your project and how does it relate to the project we have started about 10 years revolutions.
Thanks very much, Miriam, and thanks for the invitation and this opportunity. It's really great, and it's this series on the past decade is, I think, excellent. I'm very glad to be part of it because this book, which is hopefully going to be finished soon, is called The Age of Counter-Revolution, States and Revolutions in the Middle East. And it's basically my attempt to work through the experiences of at least the first part of that decade. I mean, you've mentioned how there's been a kind of second wave of uprisings. We can't speak of this as a historically ended phenomenon, but to try and come to terms with, understand in a way that might be useful for people in the future, how it was that these moments, these, what we're going to go on and talk about, how we describe these as revolutions or not, but what people call the Arab Spring, it's not a term I use often, but people call the kind of uprisings of 2011, how they ended up where they ended up, and what that kind of means from a global position. Because even if you kind of take the most pessimistic view about these events and their consequences, they were massive events. In fact, I do actually go on and mention this, and we might discuss this later, but we're really talking here about some of the largest protests in history. Certainly when you look at a kind of wave across a region, the largest participation rates by population in many cases in revolutionary uprisings or protest movements, certainly in the region and arguably the world. The largest strike waves in countries like Bahrain, Egypt, Tunisia, that they have ever experienced, and again, that are very significant in global kind of labor history, and yet they've sort of disappeared. So something happened that was called the Arab Spring, and that was good or it was bad, depending on your kind of positioning. And then there was this 10 years of utter collapse, civil war, and that's just what you can expect. And there's no consideration of the kind of line in between, which for people who are either political activists who want there to be a different world that would emerge through popular movements like this, or even for people who are not, who don't care about that, but are still scholars of societies and states, sociologists or political scientists, these huge events warrant more kind of understanding. And therefore, that's why I wanted to look not so much at the kind of, I do look at them, but not so much at the uprisings as contentious politics or this kind of thing, but what happened to them, what was done to them, what the other side, the counter-revolutions, which goes along with a kind of personal and political engagement with these issues, I guess, for about 20 years. So I teach the politics of the Middle East at the University of Edinburgh. I would describe myself as an active trade unionist and activist in various kind of political movements that are, you know, on the left, that seek some kind of different society, a socialist society, which is so different that it's hard to conceive without a massive change, and a massive change done by the vast mass of the population, not just decreed from above, which is the seed of the kind of thing we saw happen in 2011. So it's vitally important to understand, it's, to me, the really personally and politically heartbreaking consequences and experiences, although I'm not from the region, my friends and comrades there were, to know what happened to them. So that's where the wellspring for the book came from, really.
Yeah, thank you so much. And also, like, for your framing, which countries are you actually interested in? Because one of the problems, of course, that we've seen about this discussion about the Middle East and the revolutions is that sometimes there's a sort of bird view from people who have no investment or interest and knowledge about the region, which you obviously have for over 20 years. But at the same time, you do also want to give us a broad perspective. So what have you sort of picked or chosen or looked at, and how have you come to that?
I mean, it's kind of a difficult decision. I think there is a trade-off between doing something in depth and doing kind of broader conclusions. And I wasn't completely committed to doing broader versus deeper. I mean, originally, you know, I kind of concentrated in my PhD and university actually in Palestine and Jordan. And that's where I've done my most of my kind of field work, and Lebanon a bit. But I wanted to take the phenomenon as the kind of cutoff point or criterion. And we'll talk about this in a bit, I guess. But I wanted to look at those states then where you can definitely say what I'd call a revolutionary situation held, in that the political system was kind of shattered into several parts, or there was some at least transition at the top that then had to be reversed, or even that there was a civil war and a new kind of formation of states. And I think this might apply to later cases that happened in 2019, 2020. At the time I started writing, even though there were big protest movements that were part of the same wave in Morocco, I mean, arguably, probably Morocco is the closest example that could have been taken that I didn't, but Jordan as well, to some degree, even Oman. I focused in on Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Syria, Yemen, and Bahrain, because these are the places that within the kind of classical social science debates about revolutions, you can really say this is where the kind of evidence lies to have that discussion. Some people have questioned about Bahrain. Well, there wasn't really a kind of change there. It was quite short. Actually, we could talk about that later. But the uprising in Bahrain was basically the government did lose control of the country. It was... The monarchy was not in control, even though it's a very small state that lasted for a short period or a short intense period. So that's why I chose those six states. But it's a bit artificial, because we are talking here about really a wave across a region that is also part of a global kind of shift and a global series of uprisings. They're not all exactly the same, but that is the context. So you pick any case, it's going to be arbitrary. So I picked the ones that I thought would give me a chance to intervene into that debate about revolutions and counter-revolutions.
Okay, thanks. That was really interesting how you framed it. And also, I really like also the fact that you're reminding us that a lot of these combinations, selections, and listings of countries, they often are choices and random, and they are not necessarily all based on some kind of, you know, holistic, pure understanding. So I really appreciate that. I actually wanted to go back to basics for our listeners also who've heard this and who thought, wow, that's really interesting. But can you give me just a few like tools so that I can understand what you're actually talking about? And so my first question actually is very, very basic. And that is, what do we actually mean by revolution? Obviously, there are different ways of looking at revolutions as kind of like incidents or, you know, events or only things that you can see on a very long term, the kind of long durée approach. Is it something that is, in your eyes, more about a process, or is it about a moment? Because you're referring to all these moments in 2011, so it doesn't really make sense to pretend there's no momentum. Probably it is both. How can you answer if someone would say, what do you actually mean by revolution?
This is not a basic question. This is a very difficult question. And writing a book that's 300 pages long is also kind of a way to try and start answering and not maybe finish properly answering it.
No, but can you tell us at least that you are able to give us an answer in a few pages and we don't have to first read the 300 pages of your brilliant book?
Yeah, so I guess the most obvious way we think of revolution is it's a big change, right? That's the common sense way that people mean. There's been a revolution, and we know there's been a revolution because before the revolution was one way. After the revolution is a completely different way. So that's normally and people use this in a banal way. There's a revolution in washing powder. You know, before your clothes didn't get clean, now they do get clean. So this is, I think, the source of some confusion about how we talk about the Arab revolutions. And it's kind of summed up in what is still the most influential social science definition of a revolution, which I'm not saying is a bad one. I think it's actually a very kind of clear one, which is associated with the American sociologist Theda Skocpol, who describes revolutions as rapid basic transformations of a society's state and class structures, accompanied by and in part carried through by class-based revolts from below. Social revolutions, which she means are different to political revolutions, are set apart from other sorts of conflicts and transformative processes, above all by the combination of two coincidences: the coincidence of societal structural change with class upheaval, and the coincidence of political with social transformation. So that's a pretty clear way to understand these things. And it's based upon a model of revolutions, I would say, from the 18th to the 20th century. This is a modern concept. When people spoke about, for example, revolutions, and they do use that term in European languages in the 15th, 16th century, they're really talking about changes.
Yeah.
Events. But this idea that you have a big change in a society, the relations between the rich and the poor, between men and women, between various other groups are completely overturned or changed because of some sort of mobilization, mass mobilization, collective uprising. That would be our understanding of revolution. But then there's an issue here present in the definition between, on the one hand, the outcome.
Yeah.
And on the other, the process.
Right.
Actually, I think it's fair to say most people, most historians or most historical sociologists would now accept that there is such a thing as a revolution from above.
Mm-hmm.
I.e., you can have a revolutionary outcome without this kind of revolutionary process of mass mobilization. So, for example, in the 1960s and 70s, the anti-colonial revolutions in most of the Arab world, not all of them, essentially revolutions from above. They did change their societies very, very drastically. But they weren't by and large the result of a kind of uprising. Or if they were, they were in fact ways of kind of calming down or managing those uprisings.
Right.
So you can have this outcome without necessarily the process. But the process without the outcome, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a bit more like what we've probably seen since 2011.
Yeah.
And there I draw upon Charles Tilly's idea. There's a new book with some selections, which is really good, by Mona Al-Ghabashi, called Egypt's Revolutionary Situation. That what you have is a revolutionary situation, which means that there is a kind of mass uprising,
right,
which causes a split in the normal sovereignty of the state. So the political structures that normally exercise power are kind of fractured and they can't do it anymore. Not just that, but all of the, because that can happen kind of as a coup. I mean, you get that, it's not infrequent. Not just that, but the social relations that the state looks after are also kind of thrown up and open for change. So it's a more moment of, actually, this is from Walter Armbrust. I read this Ethnography of the Egyptian Revolution,
yes,
partly because of a comment you made. But he's got a great phrase where he describes revolutionary situations as anti-structure.
Right.
So that's what I'm talking about.
Right.
The revolutionary situation is the anti-structure. It's the moment when, because of this kind of mass mobilization, this huge popular uprisings, the normal way that you expect society to work, which is exploitative, hierarchical, world of domination, isn't working that way.
Right. Thank you for deconstructing this, at least in terms of looking at the methodology, the process, something that has happened from below and the dynamics around it, and then outcomes like radical change, something that is different from what it was before. Like, those are different. It's interesting what you said also about how intellectuals or academics have contributed some new suggestions in terms of relation to structure, momentum, situation. I'm interested in also seeing whether how, you know, the Arab revolutions have changed theory. I mean, but we can come back to that later. But what you just said about, like, having a radical outcome that is, you know, radically different, you have, I think, consciously not qualified it. I think that is also really interesting because, you know, if we would look at, for instance, the temporary radical changes that were implemented by, or tried at least, by forces like Daesh, you could say that's revolutionary because they wanted to completely change the system. On the other hand, you have talked about the processes on the ground, right? The social processes. If I were to be lazy and define the opposite, counter-revolutions rather than revolutions, would I just have to find the opposite description? Would I just have to say, well, anything that is not a radical difference and anything that is not from below but top down is counter-revolution, which I'm assuming is not the right answer. So what is counter-revolution?
Yeah, it's not the right answer. Like any, so revolution, because it's a political term, you know, which has its own history, and is a matter of debate, there's always going to be shades and things within it. And that's the same for counter-revolution. There is, I think, a very clear way of understanding counter-revolution and a lot, an empirical actual way, you could say, of understanding it, which I do spend a lot of the book just trying to map out, which is that it's the policy of suppressing the revolution. So it's the... It's the bombings, it's the imprisonment, it's the assassinations. And what I try and show in the book is this is an empirically, historically occurred events, which we've not been talking about, which are the reason for these kind of outcomes. But that's not all that counter-revolution is. And especially that's something, a kind of counter-revolution that can be pursued by maybe an existing state that isn't so cracked apart by a revolutionary moment. Counter-revolution is also much more of a broader project, actually, and it is not going back to what exactly the way it was before. It's a recomposition that tries to preserve or reinstate the kind of relations of power, domination, and inequality that were threatened in the revolutionary situation, which doesn't necessarily mean it's the same personnel. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the same set of ideas even. And I don't know if we want to talk about Daesh here or later, because I think it is an interesting thorny problem that's worth talking about.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think that brings me to my next question, actually. And I really appreciate that you're clarifying that, because semantics can be deceptive, right? Like when you have revolution and then you have counter-revolution, you think, well, I can solve the puzzle by just looking at what is counter-revolution, right? So you describe it, you qualify it more in terms of the policies applied to undo, like that is so important. But then, of course, why do they succeed? And the answer to this question, maybe we can also indeed look at some of the successful examples in the most, cruel term of the word, successful. But if we look at these sort of specific characteristics of counter-revolution in the region that you discuss also in your book, one of the most often heard example that comes close to what counter-revolution may mean is related to geopolitics, that counter-revolutionary dynamics or policies have to do with, for instance, external intervention, and therefore imperialism is often the concept, the case, the notion, the term that is sort of joins the conversation around counter-revolutions, right? That's not necessarily, I think, the beginning or the end, if I understand your definition of counter-revolution carefully. What do you think could be a way to better understand and explain why the counter-revolutions succeed? And is it true that if we look back at 2011 and now 10 years, that they were actually pretty successful? Or is that just the fact that we tend to remember and see more the horrible negative processes than we do the ongoing processes? Sorry, it's a bit of a complex, long question, but I think you know where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I think I'll start off with the sort of big question about reasons for counter-revolutionary success, and then maybe more on the kind of imperialism question. I think the first thing to say is just to posit this as the question is important. So my answers could well be wrong. Maybe they're stupid even. But the contribution I would like to make is to say counter-revolution is the phenomenon that you have to explain. Its success is what, you know, we should be looking at. So if I'm wrong, fine. But I hope other people suggest alternatives for their reasoning. Partly because counter-revolution is actually much more successful than we ever think. People tend to focus on successful revolutions because of the kind of definition I've given, and therefore leave us in the bind that actually the counter-revolutionaries keep on winning. But because they can win, it means they also can lose. This is not at all foreordained. There are a lot of analyses of the Arab revolutions that focus on the kind of, you could say, weaknesses or the structural characteristics of the movements and the kind of class politics and changes in basically ideological changes over the past 30 years, which I think are all relevant, but they exist elsewhere. I think in terms of how counter-revolutionaries succeed, they've got to do three things.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, they have to be cohesive enough amongst themselves with enough of a kind of policy and enough firepower to defeat their enemies, to repress them, to exclude them, and very importantly, to crush the sense of possibility that you get in a revolutionary situation. So again, time and again in revolutionary situations, basically you see people saying across the region, this kind of sense of the expanded self that they have.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful quote from a guy, Abdurrahman, just his name, don't have a surname, who was a Syrian engineer who returned to Hama in the big demonstrations that they had there in the summer of 2011. So, which were truly vast, like 500,000 people. And he writes here, I reached Hama at 6:30 in the morning and went out in a demonstration the same day. I felt like I was in heaven. My first shout was death before humiliation. Everything was happy. Even the stones in the street were happy. That's the thing that has to be crushed.
Yeah.
And that is one reason why counter-revolutions, more than wars actually, and more than normal kind of forms of police power and repression, focus so much on humiliating, breaking, psychologically destroying, and physically removing people from the country.
Yeah.
To kind of close that down. So they have to be able to do that. And in the case of the states in the region, you have to remember that they are quite, I don't want to be essentialist here, but they are quite well trained at doing so. And these are states that are kind of wired to be able to utilize these sort of practices. That's generally true of most states, though. I mean, the world of sovereign states is trained to do that. So it's quite, at this moment, that's something that people have to think about, I think. It's quite hard to defeat a state these days.
Yeah.
But where it might be found, where that might be found, is in the kind of second way that counter-revolutionaries succeed. And you'll get a balance between these things, which is to gain support. So it's not just, first of all, it's not just true that revolutions and counter-revolutionaries are really simply separated groups of people, for one thing. Second, it's not true that all of the bad guys are on the counter-revolutionary side and all the good guys are on the revolutionary side. This idea, I think, comes from a sense of revolutionary politics that is naive in a way, even though it claims not to be, because it doesn't understand that revolutions are also quite tragic, even the ones that are the most successful, and that you can't just be a revolutionary by thinking, I'm a revolutionary, I have the idea of revolution. Revolution is something that happens. You have to act in the situation it creates. And in that situation, the very first basis of support for counter-revolution is that it's quite terrifying.
Yeah.
That moment of the anti-structure, which is liberating, is also for many, and especially those who have a more substantive kind of investment in the presence in the status quo, but not just then, terrifying, because you don't know what's going to happen from day to day, and you don't know what will be replaced. So this gives rise to a very, you know, familiar kind of phenomenon that in Egypt they called the Hizb al-Kanaba, the party of the couch, which sounds like a dismissive thing to say, but I think you have to take some kind of human identification here and see, I can see where that comes from. Likewise, in Syria, what people would refer to as the gray zone, the people who would say, I'm not with this, I'm not with that. I just kind of want it to go away. I want to return to the situation of stability, however that bad that was. And that's a really significant and passive.
And they can be swayed.
Yeah, they can be swayed. Without enough of an appeal from the revolutionary side, however, that passive base of support will become an active base of support for counter-revolution, at least in part.
Right, right.
And I think you could say that some of that happened in part of the demonstrations, at least in Egypt. Then there's a kind of more active way, let's say, of gaining support, but it can be a more exclusive and dangerous way for counter-revolutionaries. So if you're at the top of these, and I should say most of the states we're talking about have a fairly clear ruling core, but then that ruling core is kind of extended through various economic cross-holdings and especially security alliances through security forces to a much wider group of people. These aren't actually just purely family states.
Mm-hmm.
But that group, to ensure that basically the revolutionary forces are divided, where they have some kind of access to an ideological appeal from the past, particularly the kind of anti-colonial revolutions of the past, so the kind of Nasserist inheritance, or in another way, the kind of laicism, kind of Tunisian version of modernization. But even to some degree, actually, this is true, Baathism in Syria, in two ways, the kind of sense of it as a national construction project, and the kind of mini civil war that happened in the early 1980s that people still remember.
Yep.
So to draw on these things from the past, or in Yemen, the again, revolution of the 60s and 70s, which was a genuine revolution that displaced an old ruling order, the Saad, mm-hmm. To reach back to those things and appeal through this counter-revolutionary in the sense of backward-looking sort of politics. But that has to be added to what we could call ascriptive dynamics. So sectarianism is the way people often talk about this, or sectarianization.
Right.
And that's not true of all this kind of states.
Right, right.
I mean, you can definitely see it happened in Syria, happened in Bahrain to a degree, and could be argued to have happened in Yemen, but it's a really complicated thing that you're talking about when you get into this Yemen situation. But there are two wrong ways of thinking about the role of this kind of sectarianization and counter-revolution, or forming a counter-revolutionary base. One is to think, actually, everyone is just, you know, people are Shia, people are Sunni, people are Alawi, and therefore they act politically according to this ontological thing. And that basically, therefore, these are just sectarian civil wars.
Yeah.
That's one wrong way of seeing it. Another wrong way of seeing it, however, is just being a Alawi or being a Sunni or something is just in your imagination.
Yep.
And that if only everyone could be a good liberal subject and be properly secular like Europeans are, they wouldn't have this kind of civil war.
Yeah.
That's not the case. And I won't spend too long on this, but I spend a bit of time in the sections, particularly in Bahrain and Syria, showing how in a similar, not the same, but in a kind of reminiscent way in which the idea or the category of race in Europe or Western societies is actually a modality of a kind of material set of relationships. Sect operates in that way.
Right.
And that is both part of the revolution and part of the counter-revolution.
Right, right. It's nice how you can even, we can actually apply Stuart Hall on Middle East politics as well.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, I would say that actually, because sects do involve religious belief, you know, they are a different thing, but there's something reminiscent. There's something reminiscent there. But the final thing, to get back to the imperialist question, is to rely upon outside powers. So remember, if a revolutionary situation means you have lost control, your sovereignty is fractured,
right,
you require some outside help. And that's usually very forthcoming, because a revolution anywhere, it's an opportunity, but it's also a threat to existing regimes everywhere.
Right.
So how do they deal with that? Classically, or the way we think of revolutions happening from, say, the 18th to the 20th century, is there's a revolutionary state and all the counter-revolutionary states, the existing regimes, come together to try and extinguish it because it's a threat to their rule.
Yeah.
That's not what happened in 2011. You actually had a group of, or I'd say probably three axes of competing counter-revolutionary states or alliances.
Could you name them? Could you?
I could, and I will. But they have different relationships to the situations in different countries.
Right.
So the first one you can easily name is the Saudi one.
right.
Saudi GCC axis, which essentially at its heart, its point is there should be no popular involvement of any kind in government in the region.
Right.
And where that's represented, for example, by the Muslim Brotherhood, they're particularly harsh on that, but it could be anywhere else. With one exception, where it weakens their opponent,
right,
Iran, they're willing to see whoever it is do some weakening of that opponent. However, they will always encourage the most reactionary kind of or anti-democratic, let's say, parts of
that
coalition.
Yeah.
That's one. The second one, which is weaker but more focused, is the kind of Iran to kind of Assad type of axis, bringing in Hezbollah, which is less concerned about, let's say, developments in Egypt or Tunisia, but very, very concerned that within this sphere of influence, these regimes are not overthrown, and therefore throws massive amounts of men and materiel at crushing these revolutionary movements. Except for, and again we come back, the desire to the mirror image of the Saudi kind of axis, which is where this weakens the Saudis, we will help out, which is what's happened in Yemen.
Yeah.
Actually. So it's a kind of mirror image. And in Bahrain, of course, you see how the Saudis completely and the GCC completely crushed and aided this really repressive counter-revolution, which was ascribed to Iranian conspiracy that didn't exist. So these axes produce mirror images of their fantasies about this conspiracy that is behind the revolution. And then I would say a third one, which is the weakest one, and which has a contradictory position, which would be basically Qatar and Turkey and the Muslim Brotherhood,
mm-hmm.
which essentially saw these revolutions as opportunities for political revolutions. So they were revolutions in the sense of limited democratization that would benefit their allies.
Right.
But that should not go beyond that limited political kind of revolution. And it's that interaction that I think explains a lot of the outcomes in Tunisia and Egypt.
Right.
And eventually in Libya as well, actually. So these three intra-regional groupings had different relationships with the external imperialist powers.
Right.
So there's a way of conceiving of imperialism as meaning America.
Yes, exactly.
And other countries are, or maybe America plus Europe, and everyone else is not imperialist or anti-imperialist. If that is what somebody thinks, that's not fair. We don't need the term imperialism.
Right.
Because we have the term America already.
True.
If the only thing we should be opposed to is America. Because, and I think this derives from, and I'd like to link this to the nature of kind of anti-colonial revolutions in a previous period, from a history of the Cold War, essentially.
Right.
Where it's an imperialist camp and anti-imperialist camp.
Right.
But even if you accept that idea that the Soviet Union, for example, is a socialist state and its allies are socialist states, and therefore its opponents were imperialist states, I don't think anybody can say now that Iran is a socialist state. It doesn't claim to be. It's an Islamic republic. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody can say now that Russia is a socialist state. It doesn't claim to be. It's, you know, a very, it's a petro state. It's an oil-based capitalist state. I don't think anybody can seriously claim that the People's Republic of China, without which there would not be a global capitalist economy, is not a capitalist state. If we understand that, if we continue with the idea that only the United States is the imperialist power, it means there is no connection between capitalism and imperialism.
Right, right.
And the fundamental argument since the late 19th century is that there is a connection between capitalism and imperialism.
Right, right, yeah, yeah.
There's a connection between economics and geopolitics, which means this is a competitive system.
Exactly. And I think most people would agree with you if eventually, if you would lay it out like this, I think most people would agree, yes, it would be a bit silly to only qualify one or two countries if you agree that the definition should include, for instance, political economy as a system or you know, its ally alliances regionally. I think the difference is more, and that's where I guess the discursive, you know, the semantics are confusing. I guess the difference is often at which level of intervention does one or the other example play a more fundamental role. And I'm assuming that's part of your analysis as well. You're not conflating by giving this more complex definition. You're not at the same time then flattening and saying, and therefore, United States, Russia, China, Iran, it doesn't matter. They're all imperial.
They're all of different levels of commitment. They're all different levels of capability. The region, I would say, until the late 2000s was definitely under the predominance, the hegemony of the United States. I think that's difficult to say now, because there's been a general retreat of, I think, decline of US imperialism. That doesn't mean it's not still perhaps the single largest player and still backing up Israel, for example, to an incredible degree. And with that, aligning with these different axes at different times. So at one point under Obama, I think they were quite favorable towards the kind of Turkey, Qatar, Muslim Brotherhood point of view, but that didn't last very long. And after the coup in Egypt, very firmly swung behind Saudi Arabia, UAE. And therefore, people don't seem to understand this, but in Libya, for example, Russia, France, and the UAE are the big kind of players. It's not America, and it's not even the consistent same alliance across the region. They shift, they change. If you look at, and they do have different levels of commitment, as I say. So, for example, in the US intervention in Syria, which was, there were two. So the one that was designed to arm local forces who were supposed to fight ISIS and would be, there were two of these sort of arms, whatever, funnels. The big one, which was called Train and Equip, train fighters to fight Daesh, that cost the US or $500 million was scheduled for it. So after 2015, when the Russians started bombing Syria, they were spending $4 million a day on their campaign. We're doing that for 5 or 6 years. We don't know how accurate these figures are, but the UN envoy to Syria estimated the Iranian expenditure in Syria as $6 billion a year. So that's before you look at how many airstrikes there have been. So there were 19,800 US airstrikes against Daesh targets. There were in Syria, sorry. There have been three sets of US airstrikes against Assad targets.
Yeah.
There have been 39,000 Russian airstrikes in Syria between 2015 and 2018. Now, that doesn't mean that America is not an imperialist power. It doesn't mean that all the evil in the world comes from Russia or anything like this. It means there are competing imperialist powers which have different levels of commitment in different areas. Russia is not terribly committed to the, it does help, but it's not terribly committed, for example, to backing up the Egyptian regime.
Right. I think
there are others who are.
I think for many people, it will be fair enough to understand that these different groupings that have different levels and different ambitions and different possibilities because of their different relationality also towards external imperial, major imperial forces. The axis that you mentioned of Iran and Hezbollah, Syria, I think the relation between this analysis and the case of Palestine-Israel throws us back to a more simplistic analysis. We want to have a more simplistic analysis because we want to see some kind of balance of forces that allows for the liberation of Palestine to be centered in what we say and do. And I think we've seen now with all the horrific actions of Israel again, and the settler colonialism, the expulsions in Sheikh Jarrah, again pounding on Gaza, it's already an open prison. It throws us back to a different kind of analysis, right? Is this familiar to you, where you feel like this discussion?
Well, I think it's understandable. I mean, there would be a very cheap rhetorical response to people who make this kind of point, which is to ask, please compare the amount of materiel and men that Hezbollah were ready to sacrifice, for example, in taking Qusair or other parts of Syria versus what they were doing now. But I think that would be cheap. I think you have to recognize Hezbollah opposes Israel. Iran opposes Israel. This is all true. And this derives from an interesting, I would say, development of anti-colonial revolution in the region, the forms of kind of Islamic anti-colonial revolution, which are not solely Shia, actually. Which also propose a kind of different sort of society. And I think people are entranced by that. And when you see what's going on right now in Palestine, the idea of putting those two things together is, it draws people to it. However, I think you need to stand back and look then at the general situation that has allowed this impunity to grow, that has allowed Israel this almost overreach, like anything they can do, they'll get away with. And it is connected to the counter revolutions. The condition of Israel acting in this way has been the success of these counter revolutions.
Right.
So the question is, do you want counter revolutions to continue to be successful? Will that actually lead to liberation of Palestine? That's one thing. Yeah. The second point is, the Palestinian resistance is now taking on quite an amazing form, in that it is not restricting itself to the boundaries established by the occupation regime, first of all, and it is not restricting itself to the old tactics and the old strategies. And to me, why would you stake your hopes on the previous kind of form of politics, which is actually what I think Hezbollah and other groups represent?
That's really, really interesting and so important, Jamie. I wanted to go towards a closure of our very interesting interview, and also like bring back what you said, maybe as a form of closing, as in, you know, that counter-revolutions, they do have a popular base, and that's something that you can't wish away, that these are the contradictory dynamics, but that they are all at the same time also conditional and related to class interest and state interest, etc., which are also contradictory and therefore change. They are not static either. So I thought that was really, really important and interesting. And I think that a lot of the examples you mentioned are actually really kind of like allowing us to sort of like maybe polish our thinking and our theory. So I wanted to end with what you said in the beginning, when you said something about, you know, how do we define, how do we term revolutions? And some of the examples you gave, I forgot the names, but Muna, but also Walter, who is practically my neighbor here in Oxford.
Okay.
And others about like the situation and the revolution and the process. What can we say about the fact that Arab revolutions are actually changing theory itself, rather than being only the case studies and the empirical confirmations of existing theories?
I think there's a crossover, because these, of course, are globally situated events. So they're going to be part of whatever conversations are going on elsewhere, at the same time as actually constituting those events. I would also say that amongst activists and kind of activist intellectuals, many of whom are in exile now, they're wrestling with these questions too. And it's not like they will all take the same position that I would Some of them might say, actually, no, a rebellion or an uprising is a better way to describe this. Or just, why do you need a term? What is this doing for you that you need this lens to see this? I think that these experiences should change some kind of... I should also say there are plenty of places where we don't know what's going to happen next, and things with COVID have been frozen or changed in some way. So Sudan, for example, is an extremely interesting example. And then Algeria, Lebanon. This is all extremely provisional. The ideas of, I think, revolution as closure, revolution as immediate establishment of a new system, to the extent that was ever valid, I think you have to think about what that would mean now. So if people talk about a revolution to change a society, that will only happen in the way that revolutions happen now and not in the way that they happened 100 years ago. So it's quite unlikely now, I think, that you will have a lot of strikes in one important place and then people will go and seize the presidential palace. It's probably not going to happen that way. I think you'll find that the very variegated kind of class subjects involved in these revolutionary situations are going to be the norm.
Right.
And that they will involve more, there's an argument about this that we've moved from a time of struggles in production to struggles in circulation. And that seizure of space, so creating a space like Tahrir, or you could argue like some of the liberated kind of zones, Syria, this kind of thing, is the way that struggle now happens, revolutionary struggle now happens. I think there's some sense to that argument, but I think one also has to learn from the way that counter-revolutionaries can crush that quite easily, or not easily, but it gives you a good target. So I think that there has to be a beyond the square.
Right.
If it's going to kind of succeed. I think also, so I want to come back, this might be the final point, to understand. Yeah. I think, so Ruth Wilson Gilmore said something like this, that, you know, a crisis is not a good thing or a bad thing. It's a moment in which other things can be created. And revolutions are like that. They are moments when new projects are available, of which counter-revolution is one. And if you talk about Daesh, for example, or their ideological inheritance, definitely Sayyid Qutb thought of himself as a revolutionary. And he said, Islam is basically, is revolutionary. It's the purest form of revolution because it's about abolishing all states, all laws, all relationships that are not those given by God.
Right.
And that is quite a popular belief as well.
Yes.
These programs will be in circulation. These projects will be in circulation. And I think we kind of have to understand that that is the moment that we're living in, where in some ways good, in some ways bad. These are projects for a reconstruction of a society, as opposed to just the kind of way that I think the Arab revolutions were misinterpreted, which is just a way of changing the political setup.
Yeah. That's really interesting also in how you began by saying, like, it's not going to be the simple story of the storming of the palace, and it's not going to be enough to only talk about the occupation of a square. And as you just ended, the occupation of the square could also be by ISIS forces. It doesn't qualify who. Thank you so much for this interview. And things are so in the air and so fluid, and it's so changing. And it's actually funny because I was thinking you may have to change some of your chapters in the coming months. Who knows?
This has been... I'm just... Now I think I'm just going to sort of stop. actually.
Well, yeah, I think, Jamie, you should just like pretend nothing is happening in the world and just finish your book, because it's already going to be very helpful and very important for us to read it. And just, you know, even if there will be a new revolution, you're just going to have to like close your eyes and ears and finish this. But I mean, joking aside, it's really interesting to know that this is coming out soon. And hopefully we can do another podcast at the end of the year, who knows, to talk about how the book has been going in or received and what changes we have seen from now till then. Thank you so much, and really appreciate it. And sitting with us from Edinburgh in Scotland, talking to us about this, hopefully soon for a global audience to hear.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation.
This is the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Thank you for listening this far. This has been a conversation featuring Jamie Allinson, who is a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Edinburgh University, with Miriam Aura, an anthropologist, internet researcher, and anti-racist campaigner. This conversation is part of a series looking at the Arab uprisings a decade afterwards. Links to related webinars, publications, podcasts, and other related materials can be found in the podcast description. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.